Danielle DiMartino Booth has an unusual background. She's worked on Wall Street, then she spent 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas, and then she totally switched gears and earned an MBA at Columbia in journalism. So now she's a full-time columnist for Bloomberg View, and she's frequently featured on CNBC and Fox Business and all the other important outlets. She's written a book. And this book includes all of her skills that she has and the experience that she has when she worked for the Fed. And the book is called, or entitled, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. And it was published last year in 2017. Hey, Danielle, welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to be here today.
So you have quite a unique background. You were on Wall Street, you're a journalist. Why did you choose the Fed to speak out about?
Well, I spent the better part of a decade inside of the Fed, so I really did have a fly-on-the-wall viewpoint. Unlike a lot of my peers at the Fed, I did not have an academic background. I had had real-world experience, which really provided me a good view of how out of touch this institution really was.
So, who contacted you and how did you get to work for the Fed since you were not from an academic background?
Well, when I had left Wall Street, I'd signed a non-compete and agreed to leave the industry for a little while. So I whipped out my handy-dandy journalism degree and offered to work for the local paper in Dallas where I had just moved for free, which seemed to work very well with their budget. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get good traction very quickly with my column because it said things that were definitely unconventional at the time, especially the comments I was making about the building housing bubble in the country. And that gained the attention of one Richard Fisher, who had just started as president of the Dallas Fed. And it was actually Richard himself who called me.
Oh, great. So you were kind of in a unique position. You came from the street, so to speak. You started writing columns about what you saw and what you were thinking about the economy, and at that time, you mentioned the housing bubble, and you could see kind of the things that were going on. As a matter of fact, you left Wall Street before the big burst, but you saw some of the early signs of the mortgage situation. Tell us about that.
Well, right before I left Wall Street, they had just started to roll out this kind of new product where if you took out a mortgage, the bank who had lent you the money to buy the home was going to sell that mortgage off to a big Wall Street firm who would then park the mortgage in a warehouse of sorts until they had a sufficient number of mortgages, which they then put into a pool and created a whole new security of these pooled mortgages, after which point they would slice and dice them based on the riskiness of the individual mortgages inside of the pool and sell them off to investors. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me at the time, who would buy those riskiest tranches? I raised my hand, I asked the question, and I got some steely-eyed mean look from an investment banker at the front of the room. Mm-hmm. But that presentation, it really stayed with me in the years that followed as the subprime-backed bonds became the mainstream and really exploded in size and allowed people who had never qualified to buy homes in this country the wherewithal to gain access to mortgage lending.
Right.
So we almost had a 70% home ownership rate. It has since collapsed back to the 64% area, which is the long-term, when I say long-term, I mean like long-term history of the country average, but allowing people to buy homes that really didn't qualify, as we now know, looking in the rearview mirror, became very problematic.
Well, you know, it was this phenomenon actually was described very well in, what was the movie about this?
The Big Short.
Yeah, Big Short, thanks. Where actually they had Anthony Bourdain, talk about in the kitchen saying, we're going to take, Friday's leftover fish, Saturday's leftover fish. I'm going to make a fish stew out of it and we're going to serve it as brand new on Monday. So it was all of these bad mortgages. Somehow they got into a pool and the rating agencies said, hey, these are now, because of the diversification and so on, the chances of these defaulting are much less. Therefore, we've got a brand new AAA product. So you saw that really pretty early, but the Fed missed it totally. Why do you think they missed it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think part of it came down to the makeup of the individuals inside the Fed. there were simply not enough people with in-depth knowledge of the financial markets who could have explained it the way that Anthony Bourdain was.
Mm-hmm.
It was simply a lack of on-the-ground, practical working experience that led to the inability of most of the academics to see what was headed straight their way.
Also, I think they were following some inflation measures. The way they measured inflation did not include the price of homes, right?
No, they didn't at all, nor did they reflect properly the fact that the stock market was going haywire.
Mm-hmm.
Because those types of asset prices, if you will, the price of the asset of real estate, the price of the share of stock, these are assets that are not incorporated into the inflation measures that the Federal Reserve follows to this day.
It's pretty amazing. Let's get some context. Let's discuss a brief history of the Federal Reserve. When was it first chartered?
Well, the root of the Federal Reserve basically started in 1907. I'll give you a quick story.
Okay.
There was a huge financial panic in 1907. As was the custom of the day, a bunch of financiers met in J.P. Morgan's parlor, and they figured out how to save the financial system. With the recognition that he was going to die one day, he recognized his mortality, the roots of the Federal Reserve started to be planted. And in 1913, the Federal Reserve was established with the individual mandate of ensuring that the buying power of the U.S. dollar was stable. And in times of duress, as in the financial panic of 1907, being a lender of last resort, look at that as just being somebody who shepherds the financial stability of the country's economy and financial system.
Fine. So I know the lender of last resort, pretty important function of the Fed to come in and reliquify the banks and to make sure that people who had their money in the banks could be reassured that their money was not going to be lost. But that changed over the years. And I want to skip way ahead. I want to get into the 90s during the period of Alan Greenspan, because something changed during those go-go years of the 90s, and especially changed because of Alan Greenspan. What were those?
Well, look, there's something that preceded Alan Greenspan, and that was in 1977, the Federal Reserve, their mandate was doubled from minimizing inflation to maximizing employment. That second mandate gave them a lot more latitude in making monetary policy than I would argue that they should have. I think that job creation should be in the hands of the private sector, not in the hands of a central bank. It just makes no sense. We have very, very, very few peers internationally who have that second mandate. Minimizing inflation is pretty much an international standard. With that being said, Alan Greenspan coming to the Fed, it revolutionized the culture of the institution in ways that are very difficult to describe over 30 years later. His biography that was published over a year ago now, I want to say, revealed a fascination with the stock market, an outright fascination with the stock market. He had a stock market briefing prepared for him every single morning at 5:30 in the morning before he got to the office in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, the fascination with the stock market turned into intimidation. And before Greenspan left office, we not only had the seeds of the housing bubble, we also had investors completely habituated to thinking that they would never lose money in the stock market thanks to the Federal Reserve. The Fed would always have investors' backs.
In 1987, we had that fairly significant crash in October of 87. Alan Greenspan was at the helm then, right?
Yes, he was. And in fact, that was October the 19th. He started on the job August the 11th. So I would like to say that he had the least amount of time on his hands to deal with major disruption in the stock market, but that victory goes to Jerome Powell, who of course saw a four-digit decline in the Dow Jones Industrials on his first day in office this past February.
Yeah, but let's get back to 87. So basically the market went down and then Greenspan came in and basically assured the market that he would not kind of let it fall any further or collapse. And that became eventually known as the Greenspan put. Now, a put is something, for those of you who don't know options, a put is really basically an instrument that ensures a price at a certain level without getting into any of the weeds on this. So the fact that market participants could sense that they had a floor or they had the Federal Reserve at their back. Can you take us forward on that?
Well, it was interesting. Right after the crash of 1987, Alan Greenspan put out a statement that said the Federal Reserve, in its capacity of the nation's central bank, stands ready to basically backstop the banking and financial systems. That was a big change. It was a huge change.
Yeah.
In the days and the weeks that followed Black Monday and the stock market crash of 1987, Alan Greenspan went so far as to dictate to the people on the markets desk in New York, give them permission to tell bond traders scattered across Wall Street that give them inside information, information that the Fed was about to inject liquidity into the financial system prior to that occurring.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to begin profiting off of leaked information. I'm not exaggerating. This is something that was documented, sanctioned by Alan Greenspan. He literally, this is a term that I'm sure you'll be familiar with, but he started out the modern day plague of moral hazard as we know it.
Yeah.
And moral hazard is effectively not being penalized for taking that incremental level of risk on as a speculator.
So the feeling is right now that if the market really takes a strong hit, the Federal Reserve is there. It's watching the stock market. It's going to inject the system with more liquidity. And therefore, you know, this lack of liquidity, this drying up of buying power is what can send a market into a tailspin. If you've got an entity like the Fed saying, don't worry about it, we'll provide the liquidity, that eases it. But what happens when you take the risk out of the market, especially something as big as the stock market? What can possibly happen, or what would be the ramifications of that in the future?
Well, we saw in 1996, Alan Greenspan recognized that there was rational exuberance and that the stock market was overvalued. At the time, the Fed could have imposed higher margin requirements, and that really would have put the fire out. We would have had a milder correction, but we certainly wouldn't have ever seen anything like the overvaluation that we saw 3 years later in 1999 with the dot-com implosion, which, of course, the Fed rode to the rescue of that, once again, placing a floor under investor losses, placing a floor under bank losses, and that then subsequently turned into the housing bubble. And then they had to do it all over again, but this time bigger. They didn't just take interest rates down to the zero bound, so to speak. They launched unconventional monetary policy and began purchasing up bonds in the open market to try and synthetically produce even lower interest rates to encourage people to borrow and then spend.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Danielle DiMartino Booth, and we're talking about her book, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. You're not suggesting that we do away with the Fed, are you?
I'm not. I'm not an advocate of ending the Fed. I consider it to be, I have a very outside view on this. I consider having a strong and independent and apolitical central bank a matter of national security. I don't even want to think what the Chinese would do in terms of attacking our financial system if they thought that nobody was actually watching over it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a huge advocate of maintaining a central bank. But that being said, I think we need to take it down to the studs and completely reinvent it from where it has been historically. I mean, one of the most encouraging developments recently, again, has been Jerome Powell, the first non-PhD in economics to run the Federal Reserve since Paul Volcker, who preceded Greenspan.
And he has started to raise interest rates back to what could be considered normal levels. He's also started to reduce the huge balance of the Fed's balance sheet from $4.5 trillion to about $4.3 trillion. It's a start, right?
Baby steps, yes.
Yeah, when you wrote the book a year and a half ago, you were bemoaning the fact that they weren't doing either of those, but that looks like they've started that. So are you feeling a little bit better about the direction of the Fed, and what would you do to fix it? What would be, you know, two or three of the main points that you would make in order to fix the Fed in your view?
Well, first and foremost, we are no longer an economy that reflects where we were as a country in 1913. So I would reduce the number of Federal Reserve districts in the Midwest by about three, and I would add another Federal Reserve district out west. Clearly, we saw under Janet Yellen's stewardship that the subprime crisis blew up in her backyard when she was president of the San Francisco Fed. it's too big of a financial area to just have one Federal Reserve District. Mm-hmm. So once you had all 10 instead of the 12 you have today, get rid of three, add one, I would give all of the Federal Reserve District presidents permanent votes on the Federal Open Market Committee. This is very important to me. And because California doesn't cease to be the largest economy in the country every 3 years, so it's never made sense to me that the presidents roll off of voting rotation once every 3 years. The same situation with Texas, the second largest economy in the country. You get my point.
Yeah.
The second thing that I would do would be to reduce the Fed's mandate back down to being singular. It would just be maximizing the buying power of the dollar, minimizing inflation.
Right.
And in times of duress, financial stability. Again, I said it earlier, leave job creation in the hands of the private sector. And then I would ensure also that we didn't need 800 PhDs. I would introduce intellectual diversity and people who had more knowledge and experience in the real world into making monetary policy such that the leaders of the Fed had actually had experience with being on the receiving end of the policies
yeah.
they make.
Yeah.
It didn't harm Ben Bernanke to take interest rates to zero because he had a pension and health care for life.
He has a guaranteed pension from the U.S. government, not a private pension that has to worry about things like interest rates and the return of their assets.
Absolutely.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest is Danielle DiMartino Booth. The book is Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. If you have a question about what we just discussed or you have a comment, please go to stevepomerantz.com. Ask us anything you like, stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where we will send you weekly commentaries and interviews straight to your inbox. Danielle, thanks for taking the time to join us.
I appreciate your time as well. Thank you.